ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument is Petkus versus Richland County. Mr. Casper.
Please, court, counsel. This is a somewhat interesting case where the activities here occurred pursuant to a lawful search warrants that were signed by the court commissioner for Richland County, Wisconsin. The sheriff's department was authorized to bring with them, while the warrant was being executed, a veterinarian and other persons authorized by the district attorney to assist in the search of the premises, the examination of the animals, and the transportation of the animals, and deciding which animals were supposed to be transported because they were in ill health. As a result of this, 350 animals that were in ill health and were dead were removed by the animal rights people. The members of the sheriff's department were only on hand to keep the peace, log the activities of the animal rights activists who came in and out of the property, and to log the animals that came in, that left the property. The sheriff's department in the county has absolute immunity.
Is it your contention that the sheriff had no responsibility for actions of the volunteers who came along?
Absolutely correct, Your Honor.
No responsibility at all?
No, because they had no duty to supervise.
Vigilante stuff, right?
Excuse me?
Vigilante stuff.
I heard that comment.
No, you're taking private people. They have no police training. They're not under the authority of the sheriff, and you're just turning them loose to assist in law enforcement.
Well, that could have been a legitimate complaint had that been the complaint that was made, and I get it. If there was a complaint that there was something wrong with the search warrant, seeking the search warrant.
No, nothing wrong with the search warrant. It's the vigilantism. It's using private people for police duties without supervision. Without their being sworn in, without their having official responsibility. You know, it's the Old West, posses and so on.
Well, I would ask you, Your Honor, is the Sheriff's Department supposed to take this warrant, and when the warrant says specifically what they are supposed to do.
Well, what does it say? It says, so it would be all right if they went to some local gang, some motorcycle gang, and said, clean up this place.
No, because the warrant specifically said who was entitled to go along on this search warrant.
Yeah, well, suppose you could get a warrant which says we want the motorcycle gang to go along with you. Isn't that lawful?
I think as far as the sheriff's department.
We want the Michigan militia. We want tough guys, you know. Only a few of us. So.
I get it, but I think as far
as... That's ridiculous.
Mr. Casper, let me ask you something more fundamental here.
Sure.
Essentially, every issue you've raised on your appellate brief was treated by the district court as having been waived.
Except for the supervision argument,
and,
which I thought was interesting.
And in your opening brief to this court, the only issue on which you even bothered to address the waiver question had to do with the damages cap under state law. And I've got to tell you, I'm troubled by a brief that simply fails to engage the district court's reasoning on all of those other issues.
Judge, I had a real hard time understanding why or how this could have been these things could have been waived when the court cited absolutely no law as to why they would be. And to me, my fundamental understanding of the law was that these issues were not waived.
Counsel, that might be an argument you could raise in your brief. But as Judge Hamilton said, what your brief did was simply ignore the ground on which you lost in the district court. And if you don't engage the ground on which you lose, you've waived them again in this court. Why should we consider an argument that the district court not thought was waived and which you have waived in this court?
Well, Judge, because the law isn't that those things are waived. I mean, it's just that simple. And the
counsel,
district court cited...
Look, if you think the district court made a mistake, you have to argue to that effect. You can't just say, I'm convinced the district court erred, therefore I can ignore that issue. That's just the definition of waiver.
Let me ask you, if I could, one more question, Mr. Casper, about the issue which you did not, where you did not waive waiver, which was the damages cap. And I understand how it's a little hard to see how that issue is even ripe until you get a verdict in excess of the $50,000 cap. The problem, I guess, I have with that is, given the different jury verdicts on the negligence and the Fourth Amendment claims, it looks like there's at least $70,000 in negligence damages that don't overlap with the $60,000 awarded on the Fourth Amendment. Right?
Yeah, I think, Judge, I think it's impossible to tell what these damages are for. I mean, if you look
well,
at the record,
we are stuck with this verdict. Essentially, every other issue has been waived. And I'm wondering about the possibility of trying to fix this and avoiding a retrial by simply saying, okay, we'll apply the $50,000 damages cap to the $70,000 of non-overlapping damages so that we would go with a $110,000 judgment.
Well, in the first place, I think it's wrong to double up on damages because, as the case I cited in my brief indicated,
the jury found $130,000 in damages for negligence, right?
Yes.
I know you think that's an unreasonable number and not supported by the evidence, but that's you're in deep trouble on that issue, okay, given the way this case was tried. But you've got a decent argument on the damages cap. But if the issue of the damages cap had been raised, frankly, to alert the district judge and the plaintiff to it, it would have been possible perhaps to have instructed the jury a little more clearly to avoid potential overlaps and get a clearer record. But we don't have that. But I'm thinking the best we can do may be just to apply the $50,000 cap to the $70,000 non-overlapping. What do you think?
Well, I guess if you're telling me that I'm in a losing situation here with respect to every other argument other than the cap and with respect to the damages, where there really is no evidence and evidence was admitted over objection as to all this emotional distress and the as well as her inability to her infertility problems. I mean, if you're going to say that all that's okay and therefore the jury came up with damages that are okay, as the case I cited says, you get damages. Damages are damages. They're not tied to any cause of action, and they're not tied to any particular defendant, and that's what the case law is.
In the problem, you're arguing about things like damages instructions and liability instructions here and the verdict form, all of which went forward without objection, correct?
I would agree with you, Your Honor, which is why I did not make this argument that any problems with the jury instructions, multiple of which there were waived because that argument was not made. But the verdict form in and of itself must sustain the judgment, and that's the judge's responsibility. And if the proper verdict questions aren't asked, it's not the defendant's burden.
What cases are you relying on? Are you saying that if a defense fails to object to a verdict form, it's entitled to take up on appeal the issue whether the verdict form is sufficient?
Sure. Duran against the town of Cicero, 653 Fed 3rd, 632, which this court decided. And
did you see the jury form before it went to the jury?
The verdict form?
The verdict form, yeah.
I'm sure that trial counsel did, Your Honor.
Did Duran involve a failure to object? I agree with the general principle. You can't be compensated twice for the same damages. I think we all agree with that. And that presents the problem with the plaintiff's cross appeal. But to come in and complain that the verdict form wasn't clear enough, which is what you're arguing about now.
It's not whether it's clear enough, or it's whether it sustains the judgment. And that's, those are two different things. I mean, it's not clear. The instructions aren't clear. The verdict form isn't clear. None of it's clear. It's a mess. And I don't know what you want me to say about that other than the whole thing was a mess. I mean, you have a pro se plaintiff who is trying a case where nobody can articulate what, why the county should be liable for any of this stuff, and then it gets...
Oh, that's easy to understand, actually. But, you may want to laugh about it, but when the sheriff brings in a lot of volunteers, and if damage is done to property, etc., it's perfectly clear the county should be responsible for that.
Actually, counsel, the Supreme Court held in Wilson against Lane that a person executing a warrant can't bring strangers. And I notice with some dismay that you don't pay any attention to Wilson against Lane. Looks like this was a per se prohibited practice under Wilson.
Is the court suggesting that the sheriff's department should have ignored the warrant and ignored the
Well, warrant might itself be unconstitutional. Do you have any response to Wilson against Lane?
No.
Well, there we are.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Glasper. Ms. Crawford?
May it please the court? My name is Susan Crawford. I'm from Cullen, Weston, Pines, and Bach in Madison, and I'm representing the appellee and cross-appellant Jennifer Petkus this morning. The first thing I'd like to point out is that the county's litigation strategy in this case was pretty straightforward. First, they removed the case to federal court from Richland County Circuit Court, and secondly, they simply held the pro se plaintiff to her burden of proof in this case. They tried the case on the theory that the Sheriff's Department personnel had done no wrong, had been, in fact, diligent in supervising the search warrant, and that no property was damaged during the search. That trial strategy backfired when the jury found the county liable on both the negligence and the Section 1983 causes of action. The county then turned to Plan B, filing a post-judgment motion seeking a new trial or an amended judgment or relief from judgment, assigning 8 claims of legal error on issues that the defense never brought to the attention of the circuit court previously. The district court called the post-judgment motion woefully developed in a laundry list of complaints. The only issue before this court is whether the district court, in denying that post-judgment motion, abused its discretion in finding that the claims were waived by the failure of the county to assert them previously at appropriate times in the trial. As this court has already noted, the defense completely ignored, for the most part, the district court's basis of ruling on the post-judgment motion, which was that the claims had been waived by the county's failure to timely assert them at appropriate points, either pre-trial or during the trial. And even in the reply brief, I would note, when the county does finally engage in an analysis of the district court's waiver, that the county cites only state law, only Wisconsin state law cases, and fails to discuss the district court's analysis and legal rationale, which is that federal procedural law applies in determining whether the waivers existed in the context of the affirmative defenses that the county raised.
Ms. Crawford, could you address specifically this issue of the damage cap?
Yes.
I frankly can't see how that can be waived until you get a verdict in excess of the cap.
Well, I see the point there, Your Honor. I would note that there was no post-verdict motion filed either orally or filed after the verdict was rendered. Rather, the county waited until a post-judgment motion to raise that issue.
Yeah, but didn't the district judge enter judgment immediately on the verdict?
No, there was a week between the entry of verdict finding and the entry of the filing of the motion.
I'm still not sure that solves the problem, but need to think about that. What about the if we were to find that the damage waiver or damage cap was not waived, what's your reaction to what I suggested earlier in terms of just applying the cap to the non-duplicated negligence damages?
Right. I think it's very clear that the cap does not apply to the Section 1983 claim.
Oh, absolutely not.
It only, if it applies at all, it applies to the state law claims. And if the court were to overlook the waiver here, I do think that that cap could only be applied to the state law claims and as the court proposed,
that's
to the
non-duplicative.
Assuming that the court also rules against the plaintiff in the cross appeal, that would reduce the a total damage of $130,000. If the court,
but that's independent of the $60,000 for the
correct. Yes.
But at least $70,000 of the. You think they're all separate, right?
That's
in your cross appeal.
That's correct.
But even under the district judge's view, there's at least $70,000 in negligence damages that are not duplicated in the Fourth Amendment, 1983.
I think that's true. Yes.
Okay. All right.
Yes.
Would it be fair to say that the damages cap issue had been raised with the district court, both the court and the plaintiff might have been able to try to adjust instructions in the verdict form so as to get make this
and
clearer?
I think that's one difficulty here is that because the damage cap was not even mentioned at any point during the either pretrial or trial proceedings, the district court in instructing the jury on damages may have altered that instruction so that it was clearer for the jury that the cap only applied to the negligence claim and not to the constitutional claim.
Does that damages cap in Wisconsin apply also, let's say, to personal injury or wrongful death claims?
I believe it does when it's a municipality.
And, yeah, that's what I mean.
Right.
And when's the last time that number was changed, do you know?
I imagine it's been a long time because that does seem fairly low.
It's extraordinarily low.
Yeah.
But
it's difficult to get such changes made in the legislative process.
That's true. Mm-hmm. So, okay. Mm-hmm.
I'd like to just briefly discuss the cross appeal, if I might. The county argues that the district court should have plaintiff is asserting that the district court erred in entering a judgment that did not credit the full amount of the jury verdict that was returned in this case. The jury found negligence in damages from negligence in the amount of $133,480 and in the 1983 claim for $60,000. The jury was instructed to measure damages separately for each claim of injury. Those injuries are separate injuries. A constitutional injury is not the same as injuries derived from negligence. And for that reason, we ask the court to reinstate that full verdict.
Ms. Crawford, one quick question more. Was the plaintiff pro se throughout in the district court?
Yes, she was.
And you all came in on appeal?
Correct.
What about in the post-verdict stage? Was she still
pro se? She was still pro se at that point.
Okay, thank
you. Yes.
Why do you say the damages for the Fourth Amendment violation are separate from the other damages?
Well, if you look at the way
that... What damages did the Fourth Amendment violation inflict?
I think it's, the way I would characterize it is that the similar evidence could be considered by the jury on both claims, both the negligence and the Section 1983 claim. But if you look at the way the jury was instructed as to the measure of damages for the Fourth Amendment claim, the court asked the jury to consider only damages that were the direct result of the unreasonable invasion of privacy that she suffered as a result of the violation of the Fourth Amendment.
Okay, that's fine, but what about the other damages, the state law damages?
The negligence damages?
No.
in that case, the court instructed the jury to find damages that were the direct result of the county's negligence, unconnected to...
What does that mean? What did that negligence consist of?
It was in the law enforcement officers' failures to properly execute the search warrant.
Well, that sounds just like the Fourth Amendment violation.
It does, but I think that, for example, if we had had law enforcement conduct here that was not connected to the execution of a search warrant, a plaintiff could still recover for negligent conduct by police officers that was separate from a violation of her constitutional rights.
What would that conduct have been? I don't understand. You suppose a police officer comes in, or one of these vigilantes comes in and does something that frightens a Petkus. So he's both violating the Fourth Amendment, or the sheriff is violating the Fourth Amendment by allowing this person to roam across the property, and also this individual is violating, committing some tort of intentional infliction of emotional distress, say. The harms are identical. You can't recover double damages for the same harm just because you have different legal claims.
Well, Your Honor, what the plaintiff's position is...
All the damage resulted here from these vigilantes roaming across the property.
That's right.
And in doing that, there was a violation of the Fourth Amendment by the sheriff, but there were also these state torts. But the harm seemed to be the same.
Well,
the jury to assess them differently, but I don't see how a different assessment is consistent with the fact.
Well, the jury in fact did find separate harms and separate damages for each claim.
Give me an example of a separate harm.
Well, because the jury verdict was not itemized, I think it's difficult to...
I think it's impossible.
I think it's impossible is a better word. But if the jury had found that the harms to the plaintiff for the unreasonable invasion of her privacy were coextensive with the harms that she'd suffered from the negligent conduct, then it should have returned verdicts that were identical for each claim. It did not. It found $60,000 for the Fourth Amendment violation and $133,000 in change for the negligence.
I understand that. I just don't see how those were different harms.
Well, Your Honor, I think that a constitutional violation is a separate harm.
No, it's not a separate harm. It's a separate violation. The harm is the consequence. If the consequence of the federal and the state violations are the same, there's just one measure of damages.
Would it be correct to say that... It takes intentional conduct to violate the Constitution. It doesn't take intentional conduct to violate state law duties implicated by negligence.
Right.
But that theory would seem to weigh in favor of the district court's decision, saying, well, there was a subset here of harm that was the result of knowing and intentional conduct. Frankly, this jury verdict the jury's a black box on this one. We just don't know.
Right.
You weren't there. We weren't there. Mr. Casper wasn't there, as near as I can tell. And Judge Conley was there and called it as he saw it. So, okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome, Your Honor.
Okay, well, thank you, Ms. Crawford. So, Mr. Casper, your time has expired, but you can have a minute if you want.
Thanks, Your Honor. I appreciate it.
Let me ask you, why did Richland County remove the case to federal court?
Boy, that's a good question. That would not have been a decision I would have made, but somebody else made that decision. I don't know. I just have a fundamental problem with what the court is suggesting here, which is that a sheriff's department can obtain a lawfully signed search warrant, do everything completely correctly within the warrant.
If you're having trouble with this, let me try a hypothetical
sure.
on you. Okay? Let's suppose it's just sheriff's personnel. They get a warrant. It's lawful. But in carrying it out, they gratuitously and deliberately inflict unnecessary damage to the property they're searching. Liability under the Fourth Amendment or not?
If it's intentional, and there's a finding of that, but there's no finding of that here.
Okay, well, that's a different problem, and one that has been waived. Okay, now, instead of employees, you bring along volunteers you're responsible for supervising, and they do the same thing. Why should the result be any different?
I can find no law, and if the court can, but I can find no law that there is any requirement for a sheriff's department or anyone serving a search warrant to supervise independent volunteers. And as a hypothetical...
Well, we've got the Supreme Court telling us you can't have volunteers in the Wilson case that Judge Easterbrook mentioned.
Right, and we've also got a Wisconsin law that says that you can have volunteers.
As between a Wisconsin law and a decision of the Supreme Court interpreting the Fourth Amendment, which do you think prevails?
The U.S. Supreme Court. Judge.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Anyway, I think that's at least my answer to your question to us.
Okay. The only other thing I'd like to mention is I think that this issue with the cap, I have never seen any case where that was even discussed, addressed, or anything until, because it's not ripe for decision until after it's over $50,000. So for the judge to say that was waived, I think is inappropriate. It's not waived until it becomes an issue and it becomes ripe as a decision. I mean, a lot of this could have been cured had the judge simply given time for post-verdict motions and had some arguments on some of these things before we had to file one brief and get a decision where there was absolutely no information going back and forth about what occurred with respect to this verdict. So...
Now, she was prosecuted, wasn't she?
And found guilty.
What was the punishment?
To be honest, Your Honor, I don't really remember.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Casper and Ms. Crawford.
Thank you for your time.
We'll go to our next article.